John McKay in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what is actually going on along the border between the U.S. and Mexico? After thousands of migrants, mostly from Haiti, built an encampment under and near a bridge in Del Rio, state and federal officials have been scrambling to address the situation. And even before the arrival of this most recent group of refugees, many politicians have talked of an invasion, a crisis of monumental proportion, shifting law enforcement and military forces to the region, they say, to cut a rise in crime and COVID. But others in office along the border call those claims overblown. We'll talk about what's currently happening along the border with the Dallas Morning News border correspondent Alfredo Corchado. That's after this short break. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. Chris Boyd is off. I'm John McKay. Few people can speak of what's really going on along the U.S.-Mexico border with more authority than Alfredo Corchado. He is the longtime Mexico City bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. Besides his award-winning reporting, Alfredo has written two highly acclaimed books on the region, Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey, and Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. His invaluable knowledge about the region, migration, the politics that seems to permeate every decision about it, has been tapped by countless audiences. Today, we add the Think audience to that list as we try to figure out what's really going on and what should we believe. Alfredo, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, John. It's great to be back with Think.
To hear the governor of Texas tell it, we're experiencing an invasion. We've got people who are coming across the border in record numbers. And, well, now they've been joined by several thousand Haitians in Del Rio, Texas, hoping to get into the country. I would suspect that the assassination of the president in Haiti and another earthquake, at least a couple of reasons that they've arrived there.
Right. And then you have COVID. You know, one of the interesting things about this group of Haitians that we're seeing is that many of them had spent a while. I mean, they spent time in Chile, in Brazil. They were gone from Haiti for a long time. I mean, obviously you have also recent Haitians. But, you know, what's interesting, just watching it evolve from here, from Mexico City, is we saw the images weeks ago of thousands of Haitians trying to come in through the southern border, through Tapachula, through the area with Chiapas, Tabasco. And we saw how many of them were turned back into Central America, yet thousands were able to head back, heck, to the United States, to Ciudad Acuña, and eventually we're seeing them trying to come across into Del Rio. The question I have and the question we're trying to figure out here in Mexico City is, what happened to the intelligence? I mean, because we're talking about 12 to 15,000 Haitians. So there's got to be a massive number of buses packed with mostly Haitians. I've also seen reports of Venezuelans and some Hondurans. But, you know, I was in Del Rio and Ciudad Acuña just a few months ago, and it was interesting how you had Venezuelans coming through that area, through Del Rio, and we asked the local authority, you know, why are they picking this place? And all along the U.S.-Mexico border, I mean, what's consistent is that on the Mexican side, these are areas that are being controlled by organized crime. So for some reason, Ciudad Acuña to Del Rio is under the control of remnants of the Zetas. And for some reason, it is there where Venezuelans, Haitians, and people from other countries, I mean, I think there were some Ukrainians, there were some people from Pakistan who were coming in through that region. So it's interesting to see how every border community along the Texas border has a certain leeway or certain passage for certain groups of migrants from all across the world. But again, a number that high, you know, 12 to 14,000 Haitians involve a massive operation. and where was the intelligence for the Mexican government or from Mexico to the United States? And there, you know, either that or the Biden administration say, yeah, you know, bring them in and we will deport them. But I have to doubt that, because I don't think the Biden administration wanted the optics of having, you know, thousands of Asians under the international bridge. Mm-hmm. And it is a humanitarian crisis, John. I mean, when we were there, again, a few months ago, talking to Venezuelans, I mean, these are people who are running away from the economy, from violence, from unstable government. So it's not that, you know, they're there for some nilly-willy reason. I mean, there's some real serious issues that are going back in their country. But you question why the intelligence, but also you question, you know, the smuggling organizations themselves. I mean, they are using some real questionable tactics and making people believe that if you come now, if you come to this region, I mean, Ciudad Acuña, Del Rio, you're going to get across. And that's, you know, as I've seen all along, I mean, these are lies from smugglers. I mean, they're making quite a lot of money for a lot of broken promises.
What are the conditions? They have to be worse than when you were there the last time, since there's so many more people that seem to be there.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we saw quite a number of Venezuelans at the time, but nothing like, you know, we're seeing now. I think some of the numbers we were seeing at the, this is back in spring. I mean, there were hundreds. I think at one point there were 700, 800. I mean, we're talking about 12 or 14,000 people, mm-hmm. squalid conditions, lack of water, a lot of children, you know, and then obviously you have the sun, I mean, the heat. So the conditions are just terrible. We understand that Sunday night they started deporting hundreds of Haitians back to Haiti. Immigrant rights groups are not happy about it, because they're using the Title 42, which is the health measure by the Trump administration, to send people back to their countries without a legal process, a due legal process. Mm-hmm. Right. So there is, you know, there's a lot of criticism, and there's a lot of Haitians who are going back to a country that some of them haven't seen in years.
So when you look at this, do you think, clearly, it would seem to me that it's just going to end up in court some kind of way for exactly what you're talking about, questions about whether or not they're following proper legal procedures in these quick deportations?
Yeah, no, it's already gone to court. I mean, it's the other part of it is remain in Mexico, where the Trump administration was sending people back to Mexico to await the court hearing. A federal judge has asked the Biden administration to do the same thing. I mean, they're under orders to do the same thing. And also in a couple of weeks, I mean, there is they're lifting Title 42, and that's going to create a whole set of new challenges along the U.S.-Mexico border. I mean, the border's never, you know, it's never a quiet place these days.
Yeah, I'm really curious now. So 12 to 15,000 people there now, more still coming?
The reports are that more is still coming, but the word is out that Ciudad Acuña is closed for business. And so the latest reports we're hearing is that a number of them may be headed for Reynosa, which is right across McAllen. Mm-hmm. I know that in the El Paso Juarez area, there's been, you know, agents have been on the lookout for Haitians coming up. In the last year, I mean, over the last year, we've seen a high number of Haitians coming into Ciudad Juarez and staying there. I mean, the big popular place at one point was Tijuana, but they are moving along the border. And you have to, you know, I mean, I think it only underscores just how serious the situation, how dire the situation is in Haiti. I mean, presidential assassination, earthquakes, COVID, you know, a really bad economy. This is not going to end, you know, just because you're deporting people back. I mean, I think I've seen some reports where some Haitians are already making plans to start the journey again.
This is not an assignment for you. You were born in Durango, Mexico. So how have you seen the border change in your lifetime?
I remember as a kid, we lived in Juarez for a short time. Then we ended up living in California in the San Joaquin Valley. But every year we will go back and forth to visit our families in Juarez, to visit families in El Paso. And I mean, people could just literally go back and forth. I mean, I shouldn't confess this, but I mean, I was not a U.S. citizen. I was a green card holder. But you would just come in and say, Americano, you know. Crisscrossing the border was no big deal. It's like more of a wink and a nod from the border patrol agent or the customs agent. It was very informal. We had a small restaurant in South El Paso Street many years later. My mother would just cross into Juarez and go to the mercado, buy her chile, you know, bring the food back to El Paso. Very, very easy. That obviously has changed. I mean, I would say 20 years after September 11, 2001, you know, the 2,000-mile border, U.S.-Mexico border, has become like an occupied, militarized territory.
You did an incredible piece and you've mentioned Culberson County, which is, by the way, when we were all excited about Blue Origin flying up, the rocket flying up, not in Van Horn, Texas. But Culberson County is also where you wrote this piece about, you talked to Oscar Carrillo, who I think is the sheriff out there, about all the numbers of the bodies of countless people that he's finding who've come across the border and died in their efforts to get here.
As journalists, we write a lot of stories, we tell a lot of stories, but that story really just broke me. I mean, that was one of the most impactful stories that I've done. Culberson County Sheriff Oscar Carrillo, on his Facebook page, he will post pictures of, he tries not to get too graphic, but, you know, of clothing and also to try to help relatives, whether in Latin America or whether in the United States, identify the remains of people, you know, people who are looking for their loved ones that disappear. And this really gets to kind of the heart of what we're seeing now. I mean, you have very unscrupulous smugglers who, I mean, these people are getting paid anywhere from depending on where they're coming from, $3,000, $5,000, $10,000. In the case of Ecuador, anywhere from $14,000 to $30,000 to come in. They're painting, you know, it's a huge marketing ploy. You know, you come in through far west Texas. There's very little presence of the Border Patrol. You come to these beautiful mountains, you know, Chinati Mountains, the Chihuahuan Desert. You walk for a day. Maybe we give you a jug of water, and you have someone waiting for you on Highway 90. That's not really happening. I mean, there are many people who are dying in this desert because one day suddenly turns into 2 days, 3 days. In this particular case, it was a story about a son and his father. His father had left, his father and mother had left the United States, I think something like 15 years earlier. And when the boy was just, I think he was 2 years old, Raul was the father, Christian was the son. And Joe Biden comes in, there's a sense that, you know, there's a new sheriff in town. He's probably more lenient, you know, he's more compassionate. Let's test that. You know, what's so sad about the story is that Christian, the young man, 17 years old, did not want to come north. I mean, he wanted to stay in Ecuador. He wanted to go to school. He wanted to go to college. But the father and mother felt like, you know, we've been separated too long. Long story short, it was supposed to be a one-day, you know, walk through the desert. And ended up dying, and it was a heartbreaking moment because Sheriff Carrillo took me and my colleague Lola Gomez to the site where just I think it was 2 or 3 days earlier this tragedy had happened, and you can still see the orange peels on the ground that a rancher tried to give him orange peels, try to revive them, but by the time the sheriff got there, Christian had just died.
You know, Alfredo, one thing that I think a lot of people don't know about is you wrote about these purple posts that apparently are in parts of the border area that I would say 99% of the country is not even aware of, that they're there or even what they are. What's that all about?
Well, you know, that's a really good point, because I've been with Sheriff Carrillo, and it's very isolated, beautiful, beautiful land. But all of a sudden, you see these purple posts. And I didn't want to ask a dumb question, but I finally, you know, what do we do? I mean, we're reporters. We have to ask the questions. I said, Sheriff, what are these purple posts all about? And he says, those posts are there to signify that they're trespassing. If you trespass this post, you are technically broken the law, and you're going to be arrested, and you're going to end up in county jail. And he says, the sheriff is in a very tough situation. I mean, he's trying to get the state to help him, but I think he also realizes that this has become a political game, and he's now preparing to see state guardsmen from South Dakota, from Florida, from other states, who are coming to save the border, to protect the border, make sure that Americans are secure. But he says, what does that mean? I mean, we're going to be educating people about the border. It's more of like, just come here, take the selfie, take the promo video, and get back home. And what's interesting talking to the sheriffs is they feel, look, the 9/11, right after September 11, we didn't really know what was happening, what was about to take place. But you have a drug war going on in Mexico. You have people fearful about, an invasion or terrorists, to come to the border. And he says, in some ways, we all kind of played up to that. We kind of played up to that game, not knowing that this was going to swallow us. And so today he's driving through these areas and he sees these purple posts, and he's, dreading getting the call that National Guards or State Guardsmen are coming in from some other place, and they're going to have to train them, or they're going to have to fill their jails with migrants who are trespassing. And he says, it's crazy land.
I think what caught a number of people's attention in recent years has been the number of very young children that were coming across, and sometimes coming across alone, sometimes with strangers. How did that start, and what's happening with all of that now? Because that seemed to finally grasp the attention of some people who just didn't even want to talk about the border.
Yeah, I mean, it started happening really under the Obama administration. And we're seeing them today. I mean, they're coming in huge, huge numbers. And it's concerning because, it's the smugglers who are taking over. And it's the smugglers. The smugglers are they're pretty damn good business people. And so I've been in Guatemala, I've been in Honduras, and I talk to people who say, the smuggler tells me if I take my kid, I have a better shot at crossing. The smugglers, in many ways, they're not just business people, but they're really plugged into all these laws and legalities. And if you bring a child, it puts the burden on the state and in this case on the U.S. government to be able to either release them. It gets a lot more complicated. So in this case, we've been talking to families who I think this is one area where the Biden administration gets a lot of criticism. There are some families who are crossing and they're able to get across because they're bringing in kids, they're bringing in children. And if those stories get back to Guatemala and Honduras, all it means is we're going to send more, more families. Which really brings a good point about, in this case, the Texas Mexico border is if you drive along the border, it's almost like every border community has a different set of standards. If you're in the El Paso Juarez area, you see a lot of single adults coming in. If you come through the Del Rio area, you're going to see a lot of people from Haiti, people from Venezuela, people from other countries coming in. And if you come to the Rio Grande Valley, you know, the McAllens, the Hidalgo County, et cetera, mm-hmm. you're going to see a lot more families in. And that's because there's so much more danger on the Mexican side that the Mexican government does not want to take families back to Mexico. So, you know, you have a situation where you're almost forced to let people in, let people come through. And which, you know, in a way brings a big point. I mean, we don't really talk much about the role of Mexico, but Mexico has a huge say so as to, you know, what happens along the border and what happens in the state of immigration. Mexico so far has been very, very supportive, very cooperative with the United States. But, you know, Mexico also wants something out of this arrangement. And I mean, we can get into that later, but I think people have to understand the role that Mexico plays and why in certain areas of the border you have children, other parts you have you have adults.
Well, what does Mexico want out of this, do you think?
It's fascinating, I think. Mexico, I think, understands that they have they have the United States, you know, where they want them. You know, Mexico would like to change the security cooperation. They'd like to get rid of the MEDIA initiative. The MEDIA initiative is started under George W. Bush and Mexican President Felipe Calderon. It was the U.S. Answer to Mexico's security problems, and it's worked. You know, I mean, it's been in existence since I think it's been 2007, 2008. But the current president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who is much more of a nationalist, much more of a populist, sees that kind of security cooperation as a way of the United States meddling into Mexican affairs. He doesn't like what he sees as, you know, Uncle Sam coming in and being able to tell Mexico what to do. So Mexico has been quietly talking to the Biden administration about revamping the program, not with something else that may not be so intrusive. And this fall, they're expecting some big announcement from both countries. You know, it'll probably change the name from the MEDIA initiative to something else, and it'll probably call for more training, but not enough, the kind of intelligence sharing or the kind of counterintelligence. You know, where according to the Mexican authorities, you know, too many Americans had too much access to what was going on in Mexico, to the security in inside Mexico. So, and you know, it's kind of fascinating because I think critics in Mexico will also say, you know, the drug war has never been worse than it is now. And so any sign that Mexico is taking a step back, I think will get a lot of criticism. But the United States feels like they have to work with Mexico if Mexico is going to work with the United States to stop the migration flow. And you're seeing some of that now. We just did a story recently on why the Ecuador migration was so high. And one of the reasons was that the visa requirements, Mexico dropped the visa requirements back in 2018. Well, just recently, Mexico restored those requirements again. And just recently, Mexicans are now flying Central Americans deep into the Mexico-Guatemala border to try to get them away from the border, try to, you know, get more control of the situation.
You know, the fear that I guess many in the United States have is that the violence of drug cartels is going to spill over into this country. And you know how violent they can be. They in fact, the cartels threatened you at one time. I think it was back in 2007, didn't they?
Yes, July 2007. You never forget that.
So you say are we seeing an increase in cartel violence right now? There are places like Reynosa across from McAllen where it's certainly a lot more dangerous than 10, 15 years ago, it seems.
You know, I haven't really seen the spillover effects of violence from Mexico to the United States. And that's for one simple reason. The rule of law in the United States works, you know, usually. And so Mexicans do not want to invite American attention. They don't want to do something stupid on the U.S. side and then have U.S. troops, you know, into Mexico or targeting a certain cartel. There's a case going on in North Texas right now. It's been fascinating. It's been covered by my colleague, Kevin Crosser. But it's really fascinating on looking at the cartels in Mexico and, you know, obviously the money, the money impact. But just the trial itself, you know, has uncovered so many layers that say so much about how these cartels operate in Mexico. But also one thing that I don't think we talked enough about is the role of U.S. Law enforcement officials, how they in many ways, you know, have also toyed with these cartels. One story we did several years ago was about these informants who were leaking stuff to U.S. law enforcement officials, who were then, you know, picking certain cartels up or jailing some of them, and then that would lead to a bigger conflict. In some cases, in the state of Tamaulipas, you know, the war between the Gulf Cartel, which is right across McAllen, and the Zetas, which is right across Laredo, you have to do some real thinking and question yourself, you know, to what degree that U.S. law enforcement officials have a say-so, have a role in these cartels, you know, essentially killing each other and along the way killing many innocent Mexicans.
So, yeah, the story said that there's some indication that they may foment this violence between the two?
Yes. I mean, that's something that that came across. And the story was really based on the murder of this. And, John, you're the longtime anchor in Dallas. You're going to help me. But there's a small little town outside of Dallas, a suburb, high end, where this lawyer for a cartel leader.
Oh, yeah. That happened in Southlake, I believe.
Southlake. That story led us to, you know, really uncover the bigger picture and the role of the U.S. government, the role of U.S. law enforcement officials in dividing these cartels, in fomenting the war between these cartels, which, you know, led to all this bloodshed in Mexico. You know, one of the biggest killings in Allende, which is in the state of Coahuila, which has now become a Netflix series. I mean, all that, you know, the U.S. has to kind of look itself in the eye and say, you know, what is my role? How did I contribute to this? That's something that I don't think has been talked about enough on the U.S. side. And that's one reason why President Andrés Manuel López Obrador wants to change the rules. He wants to change the security cooperation between both countries, because he just feels that, you know, there's way too much involvement from the U.S. side in Mexico.
This is Think. I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. One of the stories that you wrote about the region, you talked about how there were some situations in which U.S. teenagers were being paid to help get migrants across. Is that still going on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's more prevalent these days. I think when I wrote that story, it was more about U.S. teens being able to come in and work for hitmen or
or alongside hitmen in Mexico. But what we're seeing these days is U.S. teenagers who are part of the whole smuggling operations along the border. I mean, we see it a lot in places like Van Horn and El Paso, and I'm sure the Rio Grande Valley, especially with the pandemic. I mean, during the height of the pandemic, you know, there wasn't enough money, but these cartels were using teens to come in. You know, you drive your car to a certain spot. The most recent story I did for the Dallas Morning News about the Ecuadorian immigration exploding. One account of one Ecuadorian, I said, you know, tell me what the journey was like. And he said, well, I flew from Quito, Ecuador to Mexico City. Then I flew to Ciudad Juarez, stayed in some stash house. We call it a bodega for weeks. And then finally, and he tried to cross the wall. And I would say, you know, this is former President Trump's wall. It took him six times to get across that wall. He would cross, and then he was met by Border Patrol, deported again under Title 42, which is the measure during the pandemic that's been used from the Trump administration to today. On his seventh time, he crosses, he runs through the desert. He says he ran for about an hour until he saw a sign that said El Paso, and two American teens waving at him in the car. But, you know, he said what struck me was that on the U.S. side, the people who were, you know, the smuggling operation were all Americans. You know, it's, again, I mean, it's their networks that extend to both sides of the border.
You wrote this piece, and this is some time ago, that has struck me for a number of years. You said, most of us in the United States really do not understand Mexico. Still believe that?
I still believe that. I mean, I also believe that there is no other country that impacts daily life in the United States like Mexico. And yet, I don't know if it's apathy, or I don't know if it's the sense that, you know, Mexico's there, it's right on the border, and if we want cheap medicine, we, you know, drive across the border. If you want a beach, we go to Cancun. But they really have not spent the time to really understand the country. And I think that was really evident when again, you know, I hate to harp back on this August 3rd Walmart shooting, but the thing that this gunman wrote in his creed, you know, what we are here to stop the invasion. And it was like, you have no idea. You have no clue of history. You know, I mean, this whole area, this whole Southwest once belonged to Mexico. But also the role that, you know, Mexico plays. You're eating your tacos and you're eating you're drinking your Topo Chico or you're drinking your tequila. You're listening to music. I mean, you know, the influence is there. The influence is in Mexico, and I think as a journalist, I mean, that's what I think keeps you going, is this idea of trying to narrow the divide. Sometimes you feel like, you know, maybe you got across with someone that, you know, someone, you wrote an article and maybe someone understood things a little more. But I got to tell you, John, and I'm sure you feel the same way, but it's a very divided country, and it's a very polarized environment that we're living in, that I think that lack of understanding is there even greater today. You know, the ease that you paintbrush a whole country, you know, corrupt little nation south of the border. We don't do service to anyone by thinking that way.
You know, the current president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, people at first expected him not to have the greatest relationship in the world with Donald Trump. But once Trump left and Biden came in, the indications seemed to be that maybe he had a better relationship with Trump than people thought.
It was a really strange relationship.
Yeah.
But if you understand López Obrador, and I followed him since the 90s, when I was a correspondent in Mexico, it really shouldn't have been that much of a surprise. I mean, yeah. They're both nationalists. They're both strong men. They both use the media as a way to discredit the media, call them fake media. I mean, I listen to López Obrador. Every morning he has a what they call la mañanera, and it's at 7 a.m. and he will just spend an hour and a half. It's genius the way he does that, because I mean he controls that day's agenda. But a lot of the wording, a lot of the phrases, it's listening to Donald Trump, and mm-hmm. it's scary. He questions the institutions. He questions those around him. He's able to divide Mexican society and polarize society in a way that that's made things pretty difficult for Mexico today. Because of everything that's going on in the United States, I think we as reporters have spent even less time covering Mexico and explaining Mexico to our American audience. And that's bad. I mean, Mexico has elections coming up in 2 years. And, there's a lot that can go wrong in Mexico. But at the same time, I expected López Obrador to maybe have a worse relationship with Biden. And I've been surprised that the two have gotten along so well. Not that they met in person. I mean, they knew each other before Biden was president. But there's talk in Mexico that there might be some presidential meeting coming up in the fall. And it'll be interesting to see how that works. But what I've learned from the Biden-López Obrador relationship, it's that it's not very different from the Trump administration. It's a transactional relationship. What can you do for me and what can I get out of it? I will help you with immigration. I know immigration is your biggest headache. Immigration, it's on Fox News every night, and politicians are going there to the border to take their selfies. And I know this is really, really tough on you. What can I do? I was talking to a high level senior Mexican official recently in Mexico City, and says it's immigration. That's been the situation from the Obama administration to Trump to Biden. And I said, well, what does Mexico want of it? I mean, that's kind of how the story came about. What does Mexico want out of this? Security cooperation for immigration. So it'll be interesting to see how they get along in person. From everything I've heard from people who were there with Vice President Harris and López Obrador, they apparently, they had good body language, good chemistry. That was a good vibe. That was interesting. I want to see if it continues under President Biden.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who think that it doesn't matter who's in the office, which party's got power in the United States. The policy toward Mexico does not seem to change, although you could probably make that argument, make Trump the exception, but that's a general feeling, I think, of a lot of people.
Right. I mean, so much of your economy is really tied up in the United States. So much of the money. I mean, you look no further than the Dallas-Fort Worth area to understand, this new relationship. So many of Mexico's money people now live in Dallas. I mean, Dallas has become a huge headquarters for all these companies out of Mexico. So, it's money. It's kind of the follow the money situation. And we've seen that under this administration.
You used to work for the Wall Street Journal before you worked for the Morning News. Now, when you work for the Journal, they wouldn't send you to Mexico. But they wanted you to do stories about Mexico, but didn't want to send you there?
They didn't want to send me though. They thought I was too green. They thought I needed to learn to be a better writer. Which, you know, I agree with them. I was too young. But the thing is that when I started in my career in journalism, I mean, the reason why I became a journalist was because I wanted to reconnect with my roots. I wanted to reconnect with the culture. I mean, as you said earlier, I mean, I left Mexico as a 5-year-old kid. And what better way than to be a journalist, you know, to reconnect with your country and try to figure out why did Mexico continue sending so many of its people back to the north? You know, why did my father come? Why did all my uncles come? Why did my aunts come, et cetera? Why did my family come? And to me, you know, all those questions really evolved around becoming a journalist and trying to answer those questions. You started the program, John, by talking about the border and how the border has changed. I mean, one of the things that I see now when I think about my time as a kid coming back and forth along the border is I think we are robbing a new generation of that experience, of the experience of being able to crisscross the border, of the experience of really trying to understand Mexico in a deeper level, comprehensive level, and that's, you know, that's too bad. That's a huge loss for the next generation and for us, you know, as Americans, as we try to understand one another. If we can't cross into Mexico, if we can't really know what's going on in Mexico, I think we're a lesser society, especially as a Texan. I mean, as a Texan, you want to know what is it that the neighborhood needs, or what are the needs of the neighborhood? And we're slowly losing that.
This COVID crisis, it has not helped in terms of people in the U.S. concerned about each other. I'm also concerned about people who may be coming in and the abuse of folks coming in by politicians who are blaming the migrants. That's a pretty old story, migrants bringing in disease and that sort of thing. That certainly hasn't helped in those efforts to try to better understand each country, has it?
It's only exposed disparities between both countries, between both people. You know, the whole thing of non-essential travel. I mean, all it basically means, if you're an American, you can go to the border and say, I need to see a doctor, I need to see my dentist, I need to buy some medicine, and you're in. You know, you buy your medicine, then you go to a restaurant and you have a good time. It's been 16, 17 months now that Mexicans have been able to cross into the United States. I kind of fear that, you know, the day we reopen again, that maybe Mexicans are not going to want to come. And that's going to have a huge impact on the Texas economy. But I mean, we are seeing the disparities. We are hearing the same language that we heard in the 1918 pandemic. You know, one of the stories my father always tells me is that when he came as a bracero, as a guest worker, they took him into a camp, and the first thing they did was they sprayed him with pesticides to make sure he wasn't carrying any diseases. You know, it's two very different generations, but the same kind of language, the same kind of the talk.
This is Think. I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. You know, I always like to ask people this question. What works? You've been covering this for years. What people or program or idea that you've seen with regard to migration and the border, what have you seen that works that you can say, hey, you know what, you see this? This seems to be working and working well.
I mean, I think about it a lot. I think about it when I'm traveling in rural Mexico, when I'm traveling in rural Central America. One of the things that always is very clear is that the hardest thing for any migrant to do is to leave home. You know, to pack up everything and to say goodbye and not know whether they're going to come back again. What works? I mean, you have to retool the program. You have to work with the program. But I always think that at some point, if you were able to come up with a guest worker program where people could come to the United States for 3 months, for 6 months, and then be able to go back home. I mean, some people may criticize that as saying, yeah, you know, you're going to have a lot of abuse. A lot of employers are going to take advantage of that. But when I see stories, when I cover stories like Christian, the 15-year-old kid from Ecuador, and his father, you know, who barely made it, if they had the opportunity to be able to come back and forth, you know, to have the circular migration, which is the kind of migration I grew up in, you know, circular migration where people could go back and forth. I think that would help. You know, we don't talk nearly enough about the communities in Mexico that are quietly, slowly disappearing because so many people have left for the United States. You have to revive these communities. I did a story many years ago about two communities in the state of Guanajuato. One community had workers going to the U.S., mainly the Dallas area. The other community had workers going to Canada. The Canadians were under a special program where they were working for, I think, 8-9 months, and then they would come back. That community was alive and well. It was flourishing. The community with ties to North Texas was all but gone. I mean, it mostly old people, you know, waiting for someone in the United States to send them some money, remember them. But you got the sense that that community would disappear.
Journalist and author Alfredo Corchado has covered just about every event, policy change, major development along the U.S.-Mexico border. He's written two books on his experiences in the region, Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey, and Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. Books, by the way, I highly recommend that you go out and read. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, John. It's great to be on Think and great to talk to you again.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast or go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.